You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
It's always fun when I hear someone on someone else's podcast. I'm like, I wish they were a guest. And I just randomly send an email, and they happen, hopefully not to do too much research, and they say yes. So that is what's going on today as I'm talking to Daisy Christodoulou, who is the director of education at No More Marking, a provider of online comparative judgment, a former teacher and head of assessment at ARC Schools. She works closely with schools on developing new approaches to assessment. She's the author of Seven Myths About Education, another book called Teachers Versus Tech, and a book that maybe we'll get to at the end called I Can't Stop Thinking About VAR. And for those of our sort of U.S. listeners who might not know what VAR is, it's very similar to what you're seeing in contemporary baseball with the balls and strikes that are getting challenged or not challenged, which I think is a whole other fascinating thing. And I think not unconnected to the other two books, but we'll get to that. So you'll enjoy the pod. Daisy, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kelly.
All right. So in the introduction to your book, and this is the book Seven Myths About Education, you write, quote, "Education matters. And in modern Britain, all the statistics tell us that we are not much closer to a fair distribution of educational opportunity than we were in my parents' day," end quote. So I ran this idea, this quote, by several educators, including the woman I'm married to, who's a college professor, and they all agreed that this is the exact same issue in the United States. Is this a global problem or a Western problem? What's yeah. going on and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote that book in 2013. I would say things have got a little bit better in England mm-hmm. since then. But yeah, I think there is probably a global issue with access to educational opportunity. And generally speaking, it's wealthier, more advantaged students having access to better schools and teachers, and less advantaged students not having that same access. So I think it's definitely something that's common in a lot of countries, for sure.
We had a guest on the podcast not that long ago who talked about teaching being one of the loneliest professions yeah. of all time. And I'd never thought about that. I'm married to a teacher. Mm-hmm. I have taught. But in fact, often that's exactly what's going on, because you're by yourself and there's not much support system. And you even talk about teacher training being something that is maybe not all that great.
Yeah, absolutely. So I taught as well. I taught English at what you would say, I think, high school, age 11 to 18. I taught for 4 years. And it is lonely. I remember we have these teaching assistants in the UK, so sort of another adult in the room. And I remember when I started out, I used to really like having a teaching assistant in the room, just another adult there to help you out. But a lot of the time you are just on your own with a class of children. Yeah, and especially when you're starting out taking on a new class, it can be really lonely. It can be quite frightening. It can mm-hmm. be really tough. I think it is lonely, and I'm definitely someone who thinks that I don't think teacher training, not just in the UK, but in the US and in a lot of countries, I don't think teacher training necessarily does, the best job that it could do of preparing new teachers to teach. So I think there's a lot of room for improvement there.
So I was a little surprised at the beginning of reading the book mm-hmm. At some of the antagonists, the people that we talked mm-hmm. about earlier. So Rousseau, yeah. John Dewey, yeah. Paulo Freire. I mean, these yeah. are people who are someone, and then going up to Ken Robinson, oh, God forbid, we take shots. And, and again, I think to be fair to your thesis, you're not saying that these people don't have interesting ideas and not worthwhile reading.
Yeah.
However, they lead us to an idea in terms of modern education that perhaps this idea that facts are maybe not that important, which you don't agree with.
Absolutely, yeah. So all those names you mentioned there, I'm probably, yes, I'm quite critical of them. Yes, if you want me to be, if you want to sort of make the case for them, I think there is an element in which a lot of those names you mentioned, I might have some agreement with their end goals, with their aims. So I'm someone who thinks that the end goal of education should be to create students who are skilled at problem solving, who are creative, critical thinkers, who are good at communicating. I think all those are legitimate end goals of education. And I think there's a fair case to say that perhaps in the past, education's goals have been too narrow. So I would agree in a more expansive kind of end goal of education. I think where I differ from those thinkers that you mentioned and what I was writing about in Seven Myths is that I think that in service of those goals, I would argue that you need facts. You need to remember things. You need facts in long-term memory. And I think all of the thinkers you've just mentioned have a very negative attitude to knowledge and to memorization, which actually makes it harder to achieve their aims.
Why? What is it the idea that this stuff becomes rote, that times will change, facts will change, or are those all the reasons that people might eschew this idea of knowledge being taught?
Yeah. So I think if you go back, and obviously Rousseau, we can go back centuries and we can to look at these arguments. So if you go back to Rousseau, I think he's saying that the traditional schoolroom where you're trying to stuff facts in a student's head is actually very oppressive and it's going to stifle their faculties rather than liberate them. That would be his argument. I would then say you've got more modern arguments where people will bring in the technology that you talked about. So people will say, there's no need to learn facts anymore because we can just look them up on a smartphone. So when I started teaching, smartphones were just coming in and Google had been around for a while and everyone was saying, well, you don't need to learn facts anymore. You've got a smartphone. And now I feel like we're 15, 20 years on and everyone's saying, well, you don't need to learn facts anymore. We've got large language models. You can just chat GPT it. And what I'm trying to say is that all of these arguments, kind of the Rousseau, the smartphone, the large language model, all of them, what they've don't take into account is the cognitive architecture of our minds, the way that we think and reason. And so I'm not trying to make really necessarily a political argument. And in some ways, Rousseau, we can forgive him because he didn't know this stuff because we didn't have the research then to know how our minds work. But we do know now. So we don't have the same excuse to be as ignorant as Rousseau was. We know a lot about how the mind works. And what we know is that every time we think about something, when we're trying to solve problems, when we're being creative, when we're thinking critically, we are really dependent on the knowledge we have in long-term memory. So we're not doing all those things in a vacuum. And we need that memory, we need that long-term memory to be fluent, to be able to recall it fluently, and to not get bogged down. And even the little bit of friction that is introduced by looking something up on Google or on an LLM actually gets in the way of fluent thinking. And you can think of this if you are reading a passage and you don't know one in five of the words. Sure, you can look up one in five of the words, but are you really going to understand it as well as someone who knows what every word means? I don't think so.
There was an article in The Atlantic I read last night, and it's a professor who was so tired of his classes not reading books that he was like, look, I'm actually not going to give you tests. I'm just going to ask you to finish like these four books. And they did. They did so willingly. They were very happy with it. They read The Great Gatsby to the end. And I thought about this with regard to my own education. And I remember getting pulled out because I was like one of those classic I didn't do great in high school, but also like I would ace the English class. Like suddenly they'd be like, why are you interested? And I remember I had a teacher, these two teachers pulled me out. Were like, we're going to pull you out of this class. You just need to read Les Miserables, Faust, and a third book, and I forget what it was, and then talk to us about it. And I'm like, this is the best. And it really sent me in terms of a wonderful sort of educational path. And before we started this podcast and you were sort of asking me, like, what do you want to talk about? This is how it relates to my world, which is I know improvisation feels like magic. They go up there, they have nothing, they take the suggestion for the audience. But here's the thing that those six performers do have: everything they've ever learned in their life. And that is what they draw upon to create these things that seem like magic, when really they all they are is regurgitating things that you probably know. And the reason I know you know is because you laugh at it, and you laugh at it because you recognize it. No one is laughing at something that they don't recognize. So this is shared knowledge that comes out as surprise. And we certainly have to push that agenda on our students, because a lot of the reasons they chose improvisation is because they didn't want to memorize the script that they'd have to do as a straight actor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this feels very analogous to what goes on in the classroom.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with that. And I think you put that nicely about laughter deriving, if you like, from shared knowledge. Deriving, it has to be something shared, and you have to, the laughter comes from you recognizing something. Absolutely. Or the laughter can come actually from you upending what you're expecting, but the expectation is itself a form of knowledge, right?
But again, you only know it because you know the other thing.
Exactly. So that's absolutely right. And I think improvisation is a bit like creativity. We think of them both as being something that almost, as you say, springs from nothing, and almost the opposite of memorization. So students are picking up improvisation with you because it means they won't have to memorize. And people think of creativity, as I say, of being opposed to kind of rote memorization. But actually, they are far more dependent on memory, I think, than we realize. Maybe just a different type of memory. In the case of creativity, where there's been a lot of research done, people often find that what creativity is, it's when people have lots and so much knowledge, lots of knowledge from lots of different fields. And often creativity comes from applying the knowledge that you know really well from one field to a new and unexpected field. And I suspect improvisation has something in common with that, that would be an element of it.
And requires pretty tight constraints for any of it to make sense. So whether it is the box of it's 8 o'clock and you're going to be here for an hour and a half at Second City during this time you bought a ticket, that's a lot of constraints in terms of their working with that.
Absolutely.
And then in other cases, it's like, we need to do this thing. So you're bringing in all these different ideas, which again is maybe it's here. Here's the thing I certainly know from the country I live in, which is we're obsessed with like the lone wolf genius who came up with this thing. It's the Steve Jobs thing, which is like, he didn't invent the iPod, guys. You know, he did. Other people did that. Great marketer, great thing. Like, I get that, but it wasn't. And Thomas Edison had a lot of people working in that lab.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I really like the point you make about constraints, improvisation actually being quite constrained. And that's actually true of creativity too. That creativity is often springs far more from constraints, and it's actually the constraints often that give rise to the new ideas. It doesn't derive often from like complete freedom of thought. I think a really good example of this is often that way of testing creativity, which is to come up with lots of use for a paperclip. And you'll get people who say, oh, you know, the 5-year-olds can come up with all these uses for a paperclip and adults can't, and that's a sign of how adults are just lose the creativity of youth. And actually it's not true, because creativity isn't just about coming up with new ideas. There's a crucial second aspect of creativity, which is coming up with ideas that are new and useful. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. That's much harder than just coming up with a new idea. And when you investigate it, you're right. You know, 5-year-olds do come up with lots of crazy ideas for a paperclip, and a lot of them are not useful. So, you know, this is the point, whereas adults are pruning. And they are probably maybe thinking of some crazy things, and then think, well, that's actually, you know, I need something that is also useful. So I think we forget this a lot of the time. We forget that creativity is not just a kind of a sort of very, very, very flabby and undisciplined pouring out of ideas, that actually it does derive from kind of some constraints and some discipline.
I think the thing with the adults in most cases is they just need to get past the fear shame thing. Yeah. That develops over time. And quite frankly, if you're signing up for an 8-week beginning improv class, that's class one and maybe a bit of class two, and that's it. So it's not unimportant. You need to be like, hey, just, we're all going to look silly. So you look silly with us and let's go. Mm-hmm. But it can be solved pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And then you get on to the other work. All right. So we've exploded the myth of like the genius of 5-year-olds. let's tackle that Ken Robinson thing, because a lot of RIP, lovely man. A lot of people love it. What about his ideas are you maybe pushing back against?
So I think he was someone who talked a lot, I think, about creativity as well in a way that wasn't very helpful. So I think he detached creativity from its kind of underlying sort of memory base and knowledge base. I think he spoke a lot about schools killing creativity. And again, I'm not convinced by that. I think that the major and fundamental job that schools do in our society, and it's not the only job, but a really important job that they do, that they were kind of originally set up to do, is to teach basic literacy and numeracy. And I do think those are the foundation of so much else, not just creativity, but so much else. And I think, as I said to you before, I'm not saying schools are perfect. They could be doing a better job, but there are lots of ways in which they're not doing a terrible job at that basic task. And I actually think also, and this is something where I would say, you know, probably changed my mind a little bit. I was capable of being a little bit critical of schools. You know, I said in my book, actually, the opportunities schools give are not evenly distributed. But I think actually we all saw in COVID, when you don't have schools, actually what happens? Do you get students who are just at home doing amazing creative projects and flourishing in all kinds of different ways? I think we didn't really see that universally. I think we saw a lot of parents and children who were actually really desperate to get schools open again and get back into schools. And I realise, obviously, you know, there are more experiments taking place now, new ideas, but I don't think actually anyone sort of looked at that and thought, yes, this is a golden age we want to kind of be replicating everywhere. So I don't think schools do kill creativity. I think that's the title of Ken Robinson's most famous talk. I think the obviously there is a range in the quality of schools, and obviously, as I say, you know, opportunity isn't necessarily evenly distributed, and that's a problem. But I would say schools at their best do a great job of imparting some really important skills which are necessary for all kinds of flourishing, including creative flourishing.
My neighbor Josh is a math teacher, and I remember during COVID, so my wife teaches college. I was doing a lot of like talks from the home, you know, Zoom was very helpful that way. So Josh teaches math, and I remember him, I'm like, what are you doing? And he was going out to his car. He's like, I'm going to do my lesson in the car today for the kids. We're going to talk about, I'm going to drive around the neighborhoods that they live in, and we're going to talk about mileage, and we're going to talk. It was genius. And like, and the kids loved it. And I'm like, this is, talk about taking a constraint and finding it to work for your advantage, but also, and meeting these kids, you know, where they are. Yeah. And as you talk about this, it's, I get the, look, I mean, I did my thesis on the Beat Generation. I'm the youngest of six boys. My brothers were all hippies, like fighting the institution, individualism, all that stuff. But honestly, I do, as I'm sitting here talking, I'm like, oh, these institutions really taught me well. Every single one of them that I went to through my college that I rebelled against, that I had issues with. But the library was there, and I read all the books. And so I think that in some regards, this is necessary because we have to fight against our institutions. And in other regards, it's like, hey, everybody, maybe the sticking there, having them learn how to, you know, read and add up numbers is going to be a good thing in the long run.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. And I think when it comes to institutions certainly can be oppressive and be sources of oppression. For sure they can. But they also can be great sources of liberation. And so you're right. I think, you know, it is good to generally have a healthily skeptical attitude to institutions. But I do quite like that Chesterton's fence idea. That if you see a fence and you don't know, you say, knock it down. Before you knock it down, you should get someone to explain kind of what's the purpose of this fence? What's it doing? Why was it put up?
Because and the bulls are going to be running right at you.
Exactly. And I think in the case of schools, as I say, I'm certainly, we should be looking at the flaws with them and the problems with them, the ways we can improve them. Absolutely. But I think we also need to be looking at why were they invented and what would it look like without them? You know, what would we be doing? And as I say, I think they do a lot more than just reading and maths. But I am particularly interested in reading maths because I think they are so fundamental and they do allow for so much else. You were talking about the Beat poets. I mean, you know, a classic one people always say about Picasso is he knew the rules before he could break them.
Right.
You know, I think Ginsberg and Kerouac, you know, they were well read. They knew the rules before they could break them.
And by the way, Kerouac's first book is an unreadable classic novel called Town of the City. He broke a mold, but he knew what he was breaking.
Right, exactly. You have to know the mold before you can break it. And I think that's true. It's very obviously true with someone like Picasso, where you look at his early work and it's just, you know, they're astonishingly kind of technically brilliant, kind of classical sort of, you know, the drawing and the painting and the draftsmanship of them are unbelievable. And then you see how he evolves. I think it is kind of problematic when you try to just move to that breaking the mold before students have developed any of the original kind of skill to begin with. I think that is problematic. And I've seen examples of that, which I think don't work well. So, and I think actually in this era of AI, we haven't mentioned AI yet, AI bingo, how soon can you go before mentioning AI?
Right.
I think in this world of AI, I think this is going to become increasingly important, because a big hit thing you hear at the moment is, well, okay, the AI will do the sort of easy stuff for you and it will free up humans to concentrate on the higher order creative work. And I kind of get what people are saying, and there is some truth to that. But the point is, to get to the higher order parts, you have to go through the lower rungs on the ladder. You know, or I prefer to say the sort of the more fundamental skills as opposed to the lower, because that makes them sound like they're lesser, and they're not. And actually, it's through the ability to be able to read and write and to acquire those basics that we're able to then do all the things like, you know, questioning and interrogating and inferring the results we're getting from a large language model. So, yeah, I think these institutions do play a role in giving students these fundamental skills.
So my wife runs a comedy major. So one of the things she teaches her kids constantly, especially in the writing portion of her classes, mm-hmm. is you're going to be you need to make lists of observations that you've got every single day that you will then incorporate. Mm-hmm. And if you outsource that to AI, you are missing a fundamental part of your comedy making. And here's where I can bring soccer in, which is improv, which is like if you just scrimmage every single game.
Yeah.
You are not learning how to play soccer in the same way that when you bring in Second City and you're like, well, you make my team brilliant at improvising. We're like, well, we then need to start with the art of simple listening. So we're going to run this listening exercise, just like trapping. Like if you can't control the ball, you can't do anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a famous British soccer manager, Bill Shankly. I think I quote him in my book, and I say, you know, if you cannot give and take a pass, you cannot play.
Yeah.
So giving and taking the pass is kind of analogous to, learning to read and write, in that it is the fundamental skill that then unlocks so much else. And so, as you say, what's really interesting is even when you look at elite top soccer players, what do they do in training sessions? They're not just routinely playing 11-a-side games.
No.
They're doing lots of work, as you say, on passing drills. So they're doing lots and lots of passing drills.
Messi is doing a passing drill.
I know, absolutely.
And it's same with baseball. They're playing catch before the game. These are millionaires for the thing that they're doing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you'd see even with the very top, the very best in the world, they're just drilling. And often it will be quite routine drills. I think Barcelona have a passing drill called Rondo, which is just, quite routinized. And you will just see players, you know, just speedily passing the ball back and forward to each other in, you know, twos or threes as quickly as they can. And that doesn't look like, playing an 11-a-side match. But obviously you see those patterns that when you've got that basic skill honed so well and you're so good at it and so fluent that you can take the pass and you don't have to think about it. Obviously, I mean, I used to play a bit of football, and when you can trap a pass and you have confidence in your first touch, which is so important, you can then put your head up and look around the field.
Yeah.
And when you're struggling with first touch, and when you start out, you're constantly looking down. And one of the things that coaches and managers will say to young players is get your head up, you know, get your head up, look around the field. But you can't do that unless you feel really secure in your first touch. So the more fluent you are and the more you drill those basics and are fluent in them, the more it opens up those higher order sort of thinking skills and that higher order ability. And it's where you can get those very fluent passing moves that feel just unbelievably spontaneous, but actually they're not spontaneous. They're like the product of all of that practice that's gone on beforehand. And I think there's probably a lot of analogies there, absolutely, with improvisation. Mm-hmm. Because yes, you will see a pattern on a football field, a pattern of passing in a real match that's, you know, that particular pattern's never been seen before. But clearly the practice the players have had has enabled that fluency in that new situation.
I think too, it's even more maybe even banal than that with regard to the human condition. I thought about this morning. So I had open heart surgery 6.5 weeks ago.
Wow.
Right.
Great effort.
And so yeah. New valve, new aorta.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And what I realized this morning was I was able, first of all, getting out of the shower to dry myself all the way down without hurting. And yeah. I was looking up. And I realized, too, I was looking down a lot in terms of certainly right after surgery. And then until as I'm gaining confidence and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Because of course, I mean, you know, this is a pretty major thing done to myself. Yet we're all dealing with that, whether it's an internal thing or an external thing or of all that. So the ability to simply keep your head up and survey your options is a kind of gift that maybe only comes with a high degree of practice and maybe privilege and other things. And I don't think we think about all those other things affecting what it is to become
absolutely
knowledgeable and wise in the world.
Yeah. And I think what you speak to there as well is that there's a lot of things we take for granted. So actually, until you get ill and until you've had the surgery, you take for granted all those normal aspects that you could do normally.
Sure.
And it's only when they're taken away that you go, oh, hang on a minute, I didn't realize how much I depended on this.
Yes.
And I think that's true. One of the things I say about background knowledge in particular is background knowledge is what helps us make sense of the world. Mm. And often as adults, we forget we've got it. We know it so well. It's like the air we breathe. Again, you only realize it when it's taken away. And so even just simple things, you know, you read a sentence and there's a, you know, an unusual word in it, you will just take that for granted. You, as an adult, you know what it means. But that will be the kind of thing that a young student who doesn't have that background knowledge or have that vocabulary, they will stumble over. And they will struggle with, and a whole text with those, they will just keep banging into them. And that's why they don't enjoy the text and you do. It's not that they haven't got necessarily the ability to really empathize or to love literature. It's that they just don't know what the words mean often. Mm-hmm. And so you have to give them that in order to appreciate it. But it can be really hard because it can be things that we take for granted.
So let's talk a little bit more about tech. I remember when Apple did the iPad thing in California, I didn't realize it was with Pearson, who we've worked with a bunch. And so basically in 2013, they provided iPads to students in the LA Unified School District. Basically everyone, right? Got an iPad.
Yeah.
How'd that work out?
So it didn't go so well. And I think that's actually, it was LA Unified, which I understand, I think, are the biggest school district in America. So a pretty big project. And I think there was also an associated kind of a curriculum that was meant to be preloaded onto the tablets. There were huge glitches. There were huge issues with the curriculum not being preloaded in the right way. There were lots of teachers, students unable to access everything. And the whole thing was kind of meant to be this enormous breakthrough of how technology could be used in a cutting edge way. And it ended up being a bit of a fiasco, and I think was the cut short and didn't even reach the end of its contracted time. And unfortunately, that's one very high profile, very big example. But unfortunately, when you look at the history of technology in schools, you hit a lot of these examples. You hit a lot of examples of technology being used in ways that just don't work out.
And so you had that experience when you started in 2007 because you got one of those interactive whiteboards.
Yeah.
Right there we see.
Yeah.
Did you use it?
Yeah. So this is what's really interesting. I did use it, but I didn't really, like a lot of teachers, I didn't really use the interactivity. So this is so these interactive whiteboards, when I started teaching, they were kind of all the rage in England. Mm-hmm. It was a real kind of thing. And the government, you know, the central government made a huge investment in them. And it was really interesting for me because in between me leaving school and starting to become a teacher, it was only 4 years. But in those 4 years, they kind of just taken over the system. So it was really interesting because it was something I'd never seen as a student. But just 4 years later, they were in kind of, I think I put the stat in my book, they were in something like, you know, 78% of classrooms. And what I did is that what I did do and use, and I think actually is valuable, is I did use it as a projector. So I would have a set of slides, a PowerPoint slides or what have you, and I'd put them up on the projector and then the students could see what was on the screen. But I hardly ever use the interactivity. And I wasn't alone with that. And in fact, one study I think I quote in the book shows that there were lots of teachers who just unplugged. They didn't even plug in the interactive aspect to it. And actually, and there were some teachers I worked with, like older teachers, who didn't even realize it, the interactivity kind of existed. They were just using it as a projector. But obviously, in that case, it was a very expensive projector because it was a hell of a lot more expensive than just an ordinary projector would have been. And yeah, I would say now in England, you know, that was, as I say, they were all the rage in about 2007, 2008, that was seen as the future. I think most schools now have said, actually, the projector aspect of it is valuable. I think another technology which people use, which I think is more, you know, more suited to schools and teachers' needs, is a mini visualizer. Mm-hmm. So that's something where the teacher can write on their desk and the visualizer will put that onto the screen. So I think there's absolutely a need for some kind of technology that allows for shared attention on some shared content. But I think the interactive aspect of the interactive whiteboard, it was, you know, a phrase I use again and again about education technology is you have solutions in search of problems. And the interactive whiteboard was an absolutely classic example of a solution in search of a problem, in that it was a really cool piece of technology and it was quite impressive. I remember seeing it, and it did in 2007. It felt a bit like magic that you could go up with a pen and write on this board and it would write on the screen. Mm-hmm. But it was not solving a problem that any teacher really had. So teachers did have the problem of, oh, it would be really nice to be able to put something up on the screen so that everyone could see it. Nobody really had the problem of saying, and it would be really good to be able to kind of manipulate that with a pen. That was not really something that was a pressing problem for people. Mm-hmm. And so, as I say, you know, it never really got adopted and really embedded itself in teachers' practice in that way.
So this comes up all the time. We're not anti-technology. We're using technology right now to do what we're doing. You know, you have to turn on lights and other things to come see the shows here. But there's often a thing that happens with directors or producers who come in who want to load up a bunch of tech. And I'm sort of like, well, what, you know, at what point, because the reason people come here is to laugh. And, you know, is that going to make things funnier? And I know this is true for me, which is I do a ton of public speaking and I often get kind of wary sounds or looks when I tell people I don't have a PowerPoint that goes with my talk. What I try to explain to them is like, hey, for me, I've got really great stories. I've got interactive exercises. Absolutely. We're going to do all that. I would like people to understand the thing I'm saying and not fight themselves with an image that's behind me. Because guess what? There's a thing called cognitive load there. And by the way, multitasking, not a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. All of that's true. And the split attention effect. Yes. So, you know, even when people have PowerPoints, there are better and worse ways to use them. And it's that classic thing, people just pumping a load of text onto a slide, reading off the slide, expecting people to read it. You know, what value is it adding? Like, as you say, there's a lot of places where you think you don't necessarily need the slides, like people are using them as a crutch. And again, is it a solution in search of a problem? So, and I definitely see that all the time. And it's, you know, it's an issue in teaching as well. Like, definitely over my career, teaching is, as I say, when these interactive whiteboards came in, everything kind of migrated onto being on a PowerPoint. But there was very little thought about, what does this mean for cognition? And there is some really interesting theory on this, not just within education. There's a bunch of really interesting theory. I think it's Edward Tufte, the graphic designer, the cognitive style of PowerPoint. And there's all these kind of theories that there were problems in the Iraq war with junior officers trying to put lots of information into a slide deck, deleting things, you know, sticking to free bullet points because that was the PowerPoint sort of style, and actually leaving out really important information. So another thing I'm really keen on is thinking about how technology, how the tools we pick shape our thinking. So Winston Churchill was attributed to saying something a bit like this. First of all, we shape our tools, and then our tools shape us.
That's right.
Right. And so the PowerPoint is a really good example. You know, we create the PowerPoint, and then for using it, kind of it starts to shape the way we think. So I think we've got to be really careful. It's not being anti-technology. It's just being aware of the impact of technology and what it does to your thinking style. It can be good. It can be bad. It's very, very rarely neutral. It's very, very rarely that a new technology is just a completely neutral element. Like it will change things in some way.
So over time, I've become very, I'll say suspect, which is a sort of kind way of saying the thing I really feel, around personality tests, around learning styles, around all this stuff, because it just doesn't jive with my experience about how people are not one thing. I like everyone I know who's over 40 now is getting diagnosed with ADHD. I mean, God bless. My son thinks I have it. Great. I don't, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just doing what I do.
Yeah.
Where do you land with this idea of learning styles and how that affects teaching?
Yeah, learning styles is a really interesting one because it is – I didn't actually write about it in my book, Seven Myths About Education, because I thought, oh, actually people are really aware it's a myth, so I'm just going over old ground. But actually, no, it is really persistent as a myth and people really buy into it. And I feel like in England there's been like quite a lot of debunkings of it, but it's a bit of a zombie myth. You know, it keeps coming back to life. And it is a myth. And so if I try and do my best job of explaining it, and I feel like my best job is not good enough because I've tried a lot on this one and I'm not sure it's made a dent. No. But the best way I can put this is we do absolutely all have learning preferences. Absolutely. There are things we prefer. You might prefer to watch a film. You might prefer to read a book. You might prefer to listen to a podcast. I absolutely accept that. I have my preferences too. The question is not, do we have preferences or not? Like, yeah, of course we do. The question is learning in your preferred mode going to help you learn better? And the empirical answer to that is no. And and actually what the empirical answer to that is that you need to learn not in your preferred mode. You need to learn in the preferred mode of the content that you are learning. So again, very simple example. Suppose I want to learn the shapes of all the countries in Africa. So I want to be able to look at a country at a map of Africa and be able to identify every country, right? That is inherently a visual task.
Yes.
So I may not be, I may hate learning visually and I may prefer to listen to a podcast than to, you know, look at a map, but that is just an inherently visual task. You can't turn that task into a podcast episode or like you could, I guess you could have someone just describing what all the shapes of the country look like and where they fit together. But again, as I say, empirically, when you do that, you don't learn more efficiently than if you learnt it in the preferred mode. And so, as I say, most content has a particular mode which suits it. And we need to be paying attention to that. And you need to be thinking about what is it you want your students to be able to do as a result of that this lesson. And what you want them to do will lend itself to a particular mode. So if you are teaching dance, dance, yeah, absolutely is kinesthetic. It is just inherently kinesthetic. But if you want students to learn, I don't know, simultaneous equations, there is not so much a kinesthetic element to that. So you just have to be thinking about what is the content that we are teaching and what is the mode that suits that content. And that is the best way to teach it.
I had this conversation with Joe Bowler because I was one of those kids that math seemed beyond me. I'm also a musician. And I was like, oh, if you had taught me math through music, I would have understood it completely. Yeah. I understand half notes. I understand whole notes. And it was just a matter of like, oh, I had no idea that that channel existed for me in particular. And I'm sure there's many other kids and there's probably other channels that then they would understand. And certainly after reading Joe's work, which is like, oh, my God, do we teach this poorly? And oh, my God, do we use math as a cudgel to you know, keep certain kinds of people down? It's wild. And so I think that sort of supports the thing you're saying as well, which is what's the content?
Yes, exactly. And I think the other thing I'm very into at the moment, I'm reading a lot about and hoping to write a bit more about, I write about it a bit in Seven Myths. I talk about transferable skills as being a very plausible idea, but again, one that doesn't have much evidence behind it. And one of the original people who does the research where criticizing transferable skills and saying actually there isn't such a thing. It's an early 20th century, very pioneering psychologist, E.L. Thorndike. And he does a bunch of stuff, research, where he talks about identical elements. And he talks about if there are identical elements in a task, you can kind of transfer the identical elements. But beyond that, it's really hard. You know, so if there is like a shared element of knowledge or like, a, you know, absolutely concrete, specific, something shared underneath, then that can transfer. So I think, you know, there are aspects of maths where and music where I could say perhaps there are some shared underlying specific concrete things, perhaps I don't know about fractions or whatever, where I can see there is something underlying there. But then there's a lot of cases where people are just really forcing things in a very abstract way that aren't there. And so I see a lot of project-based learning where I see very, very tenuous connections between thing. So I remember, and this sounds like a parody, but it, you know, it really was true. Someone said, we're going to do a project on the theme of balance, and everything will be taught through the method of means of balance. And so, you know, we'll do balance in PE, and we'll do the balance of powers in World War One in history. And I just think, you know, you are forcing something there that is not a natural identical element, right? You know, that we have to have something sort of some specific concrete thing that things have in common, that then there are potentially ways we could tease things out, and we can see that will transfer. But when it becomes just so vague and so abstract, that just doesn't hold.
Before I ask you for your yes and story, I do want to talk a bit about VAR. So for our American listeners and viewers, American baseball this year is using ABS, which is automated balls and strikes. Personally, I love it because first, one stat that's become interesting is that over 50% of the time the umpires are correct with their calls, which I think is kind of cool. And when they are wrong, like the you know, it's very clear. It's like it's either outside or inside. It's touching the line or it's not touching the line. You get, if you're wrong twice, you lose it. It's defined. In VAR, I would imagine it's similar with the, if the ball goes over the goal line, which, by the way, if that was the case, you would not have a World Cup victory in 1966. I'm very sorry to say.
We might have won anyway.
You might have won. Yes, you might have won anyway. But like, I thought about this with offsides because I was a center forward. I was called offsides incorrectly 95% of the time.
In my opinion.
It's like, that is like, you can't, there's nothing clean about that. Like, it's like, well, which body part? Is it the shoulder or is the arm?
And you talk
about handballs with the same thing. It's like, all right, well, which is it? So this, you wrote a book about it, which I just think is hilarious. But it's of course, because like, as a fan, you're watching this going, is this really using technology at its best to help this game I love?
Yeah. So this is going to be coming soon to a stadium near you because you've got the World Cup in the summer.
Yeah.
And I am predicting there's going to be some big VAR controversies because what people don't realize is there's some quite subtle but important differences in the way that FIFA, the international body, interpret handball and a lot of the VAR rules, and the way that the English Premier League, which is probably, you know, the most watched tournament, sort of in domestic tournament, interpret them. So I think there's going to be a few controversies coming to the US this summer. But you're absolutely right. The original use of technology in football was for goal line technology, which was to say, has the ball crossed the line or not? And that, by and large, has been wildly successful.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about absolutely tiny, tiny numbers of errors. It's been going for over 10 years now. It just works very smoothly. But as you say, I think where I was sort of wrong is I thought offside would be like that. I thought it would be as simple to decide who was offside as it was to decide whether a ball had crossed the goal line or not. And actually, offside, as you say, has been far more difficult to adjudicate on because, as you say, actually, a ball crossing the goal line, it's the ball and it's the line. The human body, two human bodies, are you behind the defender, are you in front? You've got all this stuff now about ankles, about toenails, dreadlocks. You know, if he cut his hair, he would have been offside, but, you know, he wouldn't have been. This kind of thing. You've got the whole thing, can an arm be offside? Well, you can't score with an arm, so an arm can't be offside. Yeah. But actually, the upper arm kind of can be. You know, it's completely fiendish in a way that I don't think any of us sort of anticipated. I certainly didn't anticipate it. So it's a really complicated one. And it's a sort of a bit of a sort of case study in some of the limits of technology.
Well, and again, the connection to your other work seems pretty clear to me, which is like, great, we've got the technology. I understand, you know, this particular use, but it is not a cure-all for everything. And also, like, do we really want the mystery and the mess and all that taken out of everything? Because I think that's, for those of us who love going to the live experience, right? Whether that's a game, whether that's a concert, whether that's a theatrical production, it is those surprise moments that you're just not going to get in a recording that's been edited, you know, that make up what's like, oh, I just... No one will ever have this experience that I and these 300 or 30,000 or 300,000 people just experienced together in this room. Why would you take that away from us?
I think this has been a major, major issue of how it's been implemented in football. So I think one of the things about football, why it is such a globally, unbelievably popular game, is it's very fluent, it's very spontaneous. There's actually quite a few goals. So mm-hmm. when those goals happen, there is a big spontaneous outpouring of excitement and disappointment, depending on your side. So what you've introduced now is that can all be overturned. So you have these bits where everybody's up and cheering and excited, and it's like, no, actually, we need to go and check it. And there's a big thing. I mean, I go regularly to matches. I have a season ticket at West Ham in London. And there's a big issue, which a lot of fans will tell you now, that VAR feels like it is designed for the TV audience at home. Now, obviously, the TV audience at home for any big sport massively outstrips the audience yeah. in the ground. So I think this is a long-running tension in the professionalisation and the modernisation and globalisation of all sports, that you have TV audiences often in the billions and the people in the ground are a fraction and in financial terms are kind of unimportant. But I think where the people who run the game have to be careful is that the fans who are in the ground create an atmosphere that is necessary for the product. So even if you are someone who really doesn't care about the fans in the ground and you only care about the product, you still need to be aware that the fans in the ground are part of your product. And the spontaneous outpourings of excitement are kind of what people, the billions around the globe, are buying into. And again, to go back to a COVID example, obviously we had, I said COVID, schools closed down and actually people went, maybe they were quite useful. In COVID, we had all these games played behind closed doors with no fans. And sure, you could play the game and you got a result and you could have tournaments and trophies. Did anyone think, yeah, this is great, let's do this all the time? No, they didn't. Everyone thought, how soon could, let's get the fans back in the ground as soon as we can. Not just the fans themselves, but the players, the people watching on TV. So there you have it. They maybe make up a tiny fraction of the fan base, but you need to look after them.
Yeah, I was talking about this with my colleague Tyler, who went to his first baseball game in a dome. He was with some friends, and I'm like, how was it? He's like, no, it was fine. Like, I like baseball, but we live in Chicago. We have Wrigley Field, which there is no dome. They only got lights in the 80s. So, I mean, and last night, by the way, there was rain forecast. So the 6:40 game was supposed to start at 6:10. Guess what? It started raining at 6:10. There was this rain delay. It was like, but I mean, for those of us who are fans, and I'm a huge fan, I live near the ballpark. It's like, no, this is all part of it. And we won late and walk-off home run. Fantastic. Yeah. But it was all those elements that were controllable. And if they had been controlled, my interest level suddenly plops.
Yeah.
And this is anything when we talk about going to scale. I was even education. So, and I think when people do rightly use that factory analogy in education, well, it's a factory system. It's like, yeah, I get like that. Mm-hmm. Pros and cons to that, by the way, guys, in terms of access. But yes, and I will say this, and you talk about this in the book, it's like, if it's a factory system, and which it is to a certain degree, that teacher to have autonomy with regard to their ability to teach the knowledge and take that classroom and play with that classroom and impart that is our last defense in terms of this thing working.
Yeah, I mean, so I think about scalability, the ability to scale all the time. And, my day job, we do a lot of sort of digital assessment. So I'm thinking about this all the time. And as you say, there are pros and cons to a factory. So if you want the pro case for the factory, factories are incredibly consistent. Factories don't have variations in quality. They've nailed quality control. And one of the problems we do have in education is enormous issues that the variation often, people talk about a great school, a flagship school. Often what we know is the variation of quality within a school is bigger than the variation of quality between any two. So, we have a huge difficulty. And this goes back to the question we started with about the distribution of educational opportunities being quite uneven. Now, actually, arguably, potentially, like more of a factory model would help there.
Sure.
The counter argument, the big counter argument, I mean, what I see a lot of at the moment is, a bit of a push for maybe kids to be on their own on screens all the time. Yeah. And you're right, that would completely standardize quality. They would be called, could all be, accessing the same high quality content, and you're not as reliant on teachers making, things overnight and tired and mistakes creeping in. But I feel very uneasy about that. I do feel very uneasy about that. And I do feel that education, there is a really important human aspect to it, particularly with young children. And I think not just is that human aspect important in terms of the sort of, you know, more generic socialization aspects, but I even think that even in when you're talking about academic content, I think it's really hard to divorce the academic content from the sort of the socialization. So right. Why do young children want to do stuff? Like, young children are really mimetic creatures. They want to copy other children. They want to copy adults they admire and respect. You know, and often sometimes it doesn't help. Like, a lot of teachers will tell you about students who really want to do a subject because they particularly love a student, and actually it probably is a teacher, but it probably isn't the best thing for them. You know, they shouldn't be doing that subject. But that's who we are as humans. You know, we want to do things because people we respect and admire think they're important. So I find it really hard, particularly with younger children, to see how you would just cut the human out of that loop. So for me, the great tension, and it is kind of the same tension I talk about with VAI, absolutely is that, is how do you retain all those really lovely human aspects that we really want, like the fans in the ground and the atmosphere and the spontaneity and the joy, and in the classroom, you know, that human connection of, you know, all of you alighting and understanding something at the same time. Like, I remember reading that book by Louis Sacha Holes with, you know, a couple of sort of younger classes, and you get to the final chapter and they realize some of the twists and the plot twists, and you realize them all realizing at the same time, you know, and then some of them getting it sooner or whatever. You know, those moments are like the moment when a goal is scored and the cheer goes up. You don't want to lose those moments. How do you maintain those moments and also eliminate, in the case of football, the horrible glaring error that does ruin it for everybody? And in the case of education, you know, get that quality and consistency of quality, which does matter for the disadvantaged students, which does matter for students having that kind of equality of access. These are big challenges. They are not impossible. There are ways we can find worse or better trade-offs, and we should be striving for the better trade-off. My argument in my book is, with football, with VAR, we've got a really bad trade-off. You know, we've traded off a lot of the joy and spontaneity. We haven't gained any accuracy as a result. But ultimately, that kind of, you know, consistency and common sense trade-off is everywhere in life. And my point is, it's always going to be there, but we need to be pushing for better and better trade-offs.
That's great. We always ask our guests at the end of the podcast if they have a yes and story for us. Do you have one for us?
I do. My yes and story. I've said we're talking about AI bingo. We've had a roller coaster at the company I work for. We've had a roller coaster couple of years with large language models. They are the weirdest technology I think any of us have ever worked with. And we did some initial experiments, I think, in 2023 that didn't work out so well. And I remember my colleague came to me and said he had a new idea for how to integrate large language models into our assessment system. And we would use them. We would use the large language model to do comparative judgment of students' writing, not absolute judgment. And I was so fed up at that point, I really wanted to say no. Instead I said yes. And I said yes, and I was thinking yes, and are there any ways that we can also, if we're going to use the LLM, get it to not just take away from the teacher judgment, but to enhance sort of teacher judgment. So one of the things we did is we did persist with the large language models. We used a comparative judgment or absolute judgment, and we did this really cool thing, which I love, which is to get the AI to give feedback. Instead of getting the AI to just give direct feedback on students' writing, we get the teachers, when they're reading the students' work on screen, to say something about the students' writing. And then the AI transcribes it and polishes it and turns it into something nicer. And I prefer that to just the AI giving the direct feedback, because it's that thing I'm saying of trying to keep the human in there, to try and keep the human input. So when the student gets their feedback, they know it's from a human. It's just been polished kind of by the AI. So for me, yeah, the yes and was being at a point where I was sick to death of large language models and fed up with a lot of their problems, to thinking, okay, let's stick with them. Let's give it another go. Let's try a different tack.
Yeah, this is such a big thing here, because my industry hates AI. Like the creatives are, just even the mention of it is like you've committed a sin. And I'm really interested in emerging technology, and it's and I interview people. This thing's been going on for 10 years. I was interviewing people about AI nearly 10 years ago, and what's coming. And it's like, and also, I worked at Second City when we got the internet. I literally recall the wiring being done. We were the first theater with a website. And I look at now and I'm like, you recognize that all the money that we make goes through the machine that didn't exist for the majority of this legendary institution that will go on well after I'm gone. Maybe it, and the fact that we paid attention to that and utilized it was good for us. You know, maybe we need to do the same here. I don't know what that's going to be. I certainly know one of the things that we are experts in at Second City, for example, is what we call a get. And that's when we come to the audience for a prompt that we are going to use to then play with and make our magic. Well, I mean, one of the things that it becomes clear to me, at least right now, is being good at prompting AI seems to be a bit of an art, because a bad prompt gets you kind of nothing. A good prompt can be sort of interesting, could be something there. But we don't know unless we give ourselves a chance to sort of yes and do the exploration without the judgment. Yeah. It strikes me that you lean into that for yourself with this particular story.
Absolutely. I mean, we set up a Substack to kind of document our journey with AI, and it's been a complete roller coaster. And if you read it, we must come across as a bit schizophrenic, because we've like changed our mind a lot. But I go back to that John Maynard Keynes line, you know, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do? So we've had some real roller coasters, some ups and downs with it. And I would say, as you say, the debate has kind of polarized around it. You've got people who are very, very pro AI and it's going to transform the world, and maybe for the better, the worse, but it's going to be completely transformative. And you've got people who absolutely hate it and want nothing to do with it and almost allergic to it. And I think we are somewhere in a bit of a middle ground. The analogy I come back to again and again, which I'm using a lot at the moment, is I like to say, you know, like modern day Germany, is Germany kind of pro cars or anti cars? So Germany, on the one hand, has motorways that have no speed limit. Mm-hmm. Right? It also has medieval town centers where cars are banned. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can be in favor in some places, in some contexts, of like limitless use of technology. And you can be in favor in other contexts that are very similar, you know, very close by, that completely ban the technology. And so I think, you know, and that is not contradictory. That's like a completely acceptable kind of attitude to have. So what we're trying to grope towards is to get, as I say, to that point, to get to that trade-off of like, where is it absolutely vital and really important to be using this? And where are the places where we should be thinking twice?
So Daisy's books are available online. You can find Seven Myths About Education, Teachers Versus Tech, and I Can't Stop Thinking About VAR. Also, you have a Substack now, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we do. No More Marking. NoMoreMarking.com Substack. Yeah.
Great. So you can find her work there. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kelly.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.